Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to today's show. My name is Mark Kohler. Excited to be here with you. Woo! It is October 15th. How's it feel? Well, I know it's not completely over for a lot of you. I've been on the phone nonstop, even in the middle of the night with clients in other countries trying to get their U.S. tax return filed and dealing with time zones. It has been nuts. And I know, just moments ago, I got off the phone call with another CPA that I had to train on helping get a tax return done for one of my clients that is a legal client but not a tax return client. And, man, I was shocked what's going on out there. It is just tough to find CPAs that are aggressive and trying to save their clients money. I mean, it blows my mind. I'll come back to that topic in just a moment. But for those that are new listeners here, welcome. Welcome to another show. It's Mark Kohler here live talking about building wealth, saving taxes, making money, just trying to live that American dream so we can spend more time doing the things that are more important than making money, such as being with our family, our loved ones, maybe serving others, or just enjoying the good earth, you know, being out in nature and having a good time. So glad you're here. I hope to share some things in today's show that will impact your life in a positive way. Please share the link to this show. Get the word out there. It's iTunes podcast as well. It's here on Blog Talk Radio. The newsletter goes out every week. Give it a little like. Give it a little love. I'll never let you down. I want to try to continue to provide consistent shows with great topics and a newsletter that's packed with info. Today's not going to be any different. We've got a really exciting show here with Joel Labava. He is known as the Franchise King, and he is going to be on with us in a little bit talking about franchises and all sorts of good stuff here. So I'll introduce that in detail when we have him out here on the show, but I'm really excited, and it's going to be good stuff. You know, why is franchising good? Determine if you're right for franchising. Narrow your choices to the right franchise. Research facilities and procedures. Good stuff. So if you've ever thought about owning a franchise, and we've talked about it a little bit here on the show over the last year, I thought it was time to have an expert come and talk about it. He is the author of the book, Become a Franchise Owner, The Startup Guide to Lowering Risk, Making Money, and Owning What You Do. So really excited about that. So we got lots of good stuff coming on later on in the show, and we'll be hitting that here momentarily. But as usual, we talk about our kind of important announcements and upcoming events and tax tips and legal tips. So we're going to do that here a little bit. We hit a little modge podge of items. First thing I just want to throw out is please keep in mind we've got the workshops still, four more the rest of the year. I'll be in Chicago this weekend, New York the 16th of November, back in Orange County the 24th, and then out to Hawaii on December 7th. And folks, we just secured a room block at the Waikiki Beach Outrigger for anybody that wants to find a great way to get a tax-deductible trip to Hawaii. Come out and join us. It's a one-day workshop on a Saturday. You can spend a couple extra days. You won't be able to write off 100% of the trip, depending on how many days you spend out there. But a good chunk of this trip is going to be an awesome tax write-off, at least your travel over there and a couple nights hotel. Come to the event. I promise you'll save thousands. You're going to be in the workshop, able to step out, walk about 50 feet, and see the ocean right there, right from the pool at the Waikiki Outrigger. So it's going to be a lot of fun on December 7th. I'll send out some emails on that. You'll please look into it. But again, coming out to Orange County, getting a little Disneyland trip in November isn't a bad idea either, right before the Thanksgiving week. So please check that out. Those workshops are 6 hours of content. They take about 7-8 hours with lunch times and breaks. But I promise you, I'll save you 10 times your cost of coming to the workshop, which is it's $300 for a workshop. Bring your spouse for free. But I know I can save you $3,000 to $5,000 in year-end tax tips. Yeah, even if you're a current client, we always come up with something new that we're just thinking outside the box in those workshops, and especially with the Obamacare. So come check it out. Also, the end of this month, October 31st, is your payroll tax filing deadline. If you have an S corporation, if you have employees, make sure you get your payroll reports done. We've got just 2 more weeks left of that, and October is nuts. And congratulations to many of you out there, again, working on your taxes today. I know many of you are still going to be filing tonight at midnight. I haven't signed mine yet today. Now, what we bring you here every week are some tax and legal tips, and I'm honored here. I think we've got the man, the myth, the legend, the senior partner at the accounting firm, Liddell Ayer, my partner in crime, just mentor to me and friend and brother, and he's here on the show with us, which I can't believe we're getting here on October 15th. So I want to give him a big welcome. Liddell, is that you? Are you really here on the show today?
Well, I pre-recorded this, but we'll see how it goes.
Pre-recorded. Dude, that was good. That was pretty technical. I like that.
Well, I'm here, actually. I can't believe I jumped in, but I did.
Oh, well, thank you. Folks, you don't even know. Last night at 11 o'clock at night, I'm texting Liddell, hey, have you got this number? What about this? What about that? So we were up late, and he's been working around the clock. So it'll be nice to have today over.
Yes, it will.
Yeah, okay. Well, Liddell, what do you got a little tip for us this week? What did you run into this week with some clients on their tax returns? What little something might you have?
This is an easy one. If you have not filed, file today. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
I like it. That's a good one. You know, on that note, though, I will say this. How many people don't file because they're afraid they can't pay and then the penalties get worse? So that is not a bad point.
That's right. You're much better to file and then deal with it later, you know, deal with it as you go, because that late filing penalties, you know, really adds up. So it is best to file and then deal with a payment plan, installment agreement, whatever it may be. That's the best way to do it. But I did have a couple of things for today. As we're getting close to year end, a couple of things to keep in mind. One of them is the purchasing of business equipment. That limitation, that Section 179, is at $500,000 for 2013. That will drop to $25,000 from $500,000 to $25,000 in 2014 if Congress doesn't do any sort of extension, which we can see how things are going in Washington right now. There's, you know, what's the chance of a new tax law enactment by year end or some extensions? They can't even agree to increase debt or, you know, do what they need to do. So that's one thing. Keep in mind, if you're going to purchase a large amount of equipment, this is the year to do it. $500,000, Section 179 being able to expense it. The other one is if it's new equipment, maybe you don't have a lot of income, but you want to show a loss and go back and get some of that prior year, you still have the ability to do what they call bonus depreciation, which is the 50% of your new equipment purchase amount. So those are a couple of things. One other thing I wanted to throw out just quickly has to do with using your IRA to make a charitable contribution. You can still do that in 2013 if you make the charitable contribution directly from the IRA. Now, that makes it so you do not have to pick that amount up in income, but you do get the charitable deduction, but it has to come directly from your IRA. So don't take the money out, put it in your checking account, and then go make the charitable contribution, because you'll have to pick it up as income. So I just wanted to make point, there are a couple of several expiring provisions at the end of 2013 that don't go into 2014. I guess we're kind of like we were at the end of 2012 coming into 2013. We didn't know what we had to work with. And it looks like it may be that same sort of thing again this year.
Yeah, it really is kind of a mini fiscal cliff, the fiscal curb, as some have already started to call it. So it's, and then I heard in the news that they're going to pass a spending bill that will expire come January. So Congress is setting themselves up for a lot of work after Christmas, and so dysfunctional. It's just so frustrating for, I know, so many Americans. It is me. Hey, Liddell, let's talk about a quick example here. So let's put some context to this. I just had a text from a client yesterday. I know he'll probably be listening today. He bought a boat this year. Now, when Liddell's saying, oh, you can write off up to 500 grand and buy equipment and get a write-off and this and that, you know, some of us think, well, I don't buy equipment. That doesn't impact me. Well, this client bought a boat that he is only using for client development and for his employees. He never goes out on it personally. Now, this is his story, Liddell. This is what he tells me. he never goes out on it personally, this boat. And he only uses it when he's got a client on the a customer, or he's got an employee trip or employee training session. They'll go out on this boat. Now, this was about a $50,000 boat, but Liddell, if I'm not mistaken, this could fall in that equipment realm. What are your thoughts on a strategy like that?
Well, first off, if he wants a full deduction with no questions, start up a fishing business.
Oh,
no!
Very interesting.
There you are.
So do a little touring. Now, that could be touring as well, right? I mean, he could just be
touring or
fishing tours.
Yeah, it's got to be a business. Now, I've seen audits come down before with this sort of thing, either hunting, you know, lodges, whatever, boating, you know, boats. Those lend themselves to very personal type things, and it would be scrutinized. Because there's such a personal nature to having a boat, you know, water skiing, sailboating, whatever it may be. I think the IRS is going to give somebody a lot of trouble if they tried to Section 179 that boat and say it was 100% business. Unless, like we're saying, unless they're in the business of fishing, touring, those type of things we've mentioned, I think it would be a real stretch, so to speak, to be able to Section 179 that boat.
Well, and here's what I told the client, too, is right down that vein, is that you better document the travel and trips with that boat very carefully. Who's going to be on the boat when you do go? What are the dates it goes out in the water? Is it slipped? Is it not? For those that don't know a slip, that's kind of that little dock where your boat's always sitting in the water. And I've told him that I'm not a 100% business use kind of guy when it comes to those sorts of things, because the IRS knows you're going to take the boat out on a Sunday afternoon with family. They just know it. So if you can come down to maybe a 70 to 80% business use, document your trips very carefully. I think it's doable. Just document, right, Liddell?
Right. And you know, And you have to be over 50% business use to be able to Section 179 too. So, you know, if the hours come in that you are below the 50% business use, you can't Section 179 it. So you would have to document that you are over that 50% business use.
Now, here's what we've created. We've created a massive problem today for a number of marriages, because what's going to happen is some guy is going to listen to our show today and go, hold it, honey, I was listening to Mark and Liddell today. If by the end of this year, if I don't buy a new boat by the end of the year, I'm going to lose out on the write-off. And so we got to do it.
It's usually a new truck or something like that.
Yeah, that's right, which is in the mix too. So, well, anyway, I think a lot of fun. So great tip. Liddell, thank you so much for joining the show. I sure appreciate it.
Sure. Have a good one.
Folks, if you need to get a hold of Liddell, you want to consult with him, you can contact him directly at the firm. Of course, if you're listening to the show, you know how to get a hold of us. Liddell really does specialize in construction, small business, agriculture, and does a fantastic job with clients that have that farm, ranch, fishing, hunting lodge business. So he understands that personal use aspect. So check it out. Hey, one side note, everyone, when this client was contacting me yesterday about the boat, he said, Mark, should I pay off the boat and should my corporation own it? And I said, I don't care if your corporation owns it. And number two, if you buy it with credit, you can still 179 it and write off the bulk of the boat. Now, I heard his wife on the phone that when I told him that, just go, I can't believe Mark okayed this. So I got in trouble for that one. But here's the point. It is a possibility. Make sure that you're, want a boat. You know, anybody that's owned a boat knows that they're a lot more expensive than just the sticker price. So be careful out there. All right. Well, let's jump over to a quick legal tip. We've got Jaron Bergeson, a regular on the show, that comes out with a legal item that he may have encountered this past week, an attorney in three or four states, a huge asset to many of our clients around the country. Jaron, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mark. And I've heard the best 2 days in the life of a boat owner are the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat. So I'm just saying that tends to be the case, is they want to get it off their hands at some point. And I also hope to ruin less marriages than you and Liddell did during his tip. So
there you go. You know, maybe we could add like the three best days in a boat owner's life is the day they buy it, the day they get to write it off, and then the day they sell it. So
there you go. Perfect.
There's got to be a tax angle here somewhere.
So, there you go.
I like it. Hey, Jaron, too, I got a couple comments on the chat line here by Ray. How about those Utes taking out Stanford, huh?
Woo! You know what? It was bittersweet for a Cougar. It makes our loss to you guys look a little bit better, but I never like to see the Utes have all that much success, so it was kind of tough.
Yeah, it was a beautiful weekend. Oh, it was great. Well, anyway, we won't talk football. Folks, if you didn't know, Jaron is he could have been an ESPN commentator, which I think was in your agenda early on, as any good sports fanatic would dream of a job at ESPN. But we won't get into sports today. What do you got for us? What's your legal tip today?
You know, I had a client come in last week who was kind of – she was getting ready to kind of start living her American dream. She was going to start up a business she was getting ready to that was for nutrition and education coaching that had to do with nutrition, and she wanted to get that started. And so we talked about, you know, why a business entity might make sense and what business entity would make sense from a legal and tax perspective, and we started talking about LLCs. And she said, well, my husband has an LLC in our home state that he never did anything with. He just basically registered it with the Secretary of State's office, and he's paid the renewal fees, but he's never done anything else with it. So I brought it up online and saw that it was in good standing, and she said all he has are these articles of organization, and that's it. And it turns out that we were able to, through our corporate cleanup product that we have, we were able to salvage that entity and save her some money. She didn't have to go out and set up a new entity that she was going to have to pay for and maintain. We were able to get an operating agreement in there and do all of the other services that we do in a corporate cleanup, paper the LLC, make sure that it had annual minutes for the last couple years. And you know, it just got me thinking about what a good service that can be to people out there who have an entity that maybe they've never done anything with, and that now they want to, or you know, they don't know what status it's in, and they've never had an operating agreement or bylaws for a corporation. You know, that's a great way to go if you've got an entity out there that you've done nothing with. We may be able to salvage it, and you may be able to use it going forward, and we can save you some money in the long run and get you those asset protection characteristics of an entity and possibly save some taxes depending on what kind of entity it is.
Well, and, you know, I think this is a great tip. And, you know, the hard part here is a lot of people will go online and just try to search throughout the evening until they think they found the best entity for themselves. And click, 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 buy some company. They don't have all the guts and the pieces and parts they should have. And sometimes spending time with a professional that's working with entities every day, like a Jaron, you can realize that some of the structures you already have in place could be utilized, cleaned up, and modified, and you actually save money in the process. But I know how hard it is. Many of our listeners out there, they're very concerned about picking up a call with an attorney or a CPA, and is it going to be worth it, and is it worth the cost? Well, our goal, and I know this is the truth, what I think with many attorneys and CPAs are out there trying to do the right thing, is their goal is to build a long-lasting relationship. And if they shortcut it and rip you off on that first entity, they're not going to have you as a client next year, that's for sure. So I think this is a really good point, Jerem, that you can oftentimes salvage what you're working with already and not have to pay the cost of a whole new setup. I had a call just like that yesterday. On this LLC thing, let's just talk mm-hmm. about the ongoing maintenance. What are some things people should think about once they do get their entity cleaned up? Some people have debated, well, do I have to have minutes and meetings with my LLC? Is it necessary? Is it helpful? What's your take on all that?
I think you're never going to regret having done an annual meeting and having annual minutes, or at least having minutes each year for your LLC, sometimes it's required in annual reports and so forth for a corporation. But in any business entity, you're never going to say, gosh, I wish I hadn't done that. On the flip side, there are lots of instances where you'll go, if you don't do it, where you'll say, gosh, I wish I had done those annual minutes. If your LLC ever gets sued, ever gets audited, those are documents that don't seem like much when you're doing them, but that you're going to be extraordinarily glad that you have in one of those two eventualities, because that's going to show that you're keeping up with the corporate formalities. It's going to help you preserve your corporate veil protection. If you've been taking tax write-offs or deductions or certain strategies that depend on what kind of business entity you are, then in an audit, you're also going to be real happy that you've done that.
Yeah, great points. And I think many of us realize that the LLC, and I'm just going to say it for those out there that might be new to the structure, you've got that manager role, that team of advisors. You can still set up a board of advisors that can be a wonderful resource to you in your business and can be part of that annual meeting. Like I was just talking about, take a trip this fall, do your annual training, come to a workshop, and then have your annual meeting as part of that, and those can be your board of advisors. They don't have to be a president, secretary, treasurer in a corporation. They can still be integrated into your LLC structure as well. But again, everybody's business is a little different, but great tip, Jerem. Thanks so much for bringing that to the show today. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
We'll catch you on the backside. Jerem Bergeson, folks, a regular contributor to the show and an NFL statistical genius. So you'll have to quiz him when he covers the show. He knows the score of every Super Bowl, who the MVP was, and where the game was played. It's kind of interesting. You just put him on the spot. He's got it. It's amazing, actually. All right, now I've got one more tip I need to share with you before we bring our special guest on the show today, and I introduce the topic of franchising. We've got to talk about Obamacare here again for another moment. This is, again, going to be a topic we'll hit over and over again over the next 3 to 4 months in this transition. There's some good things about Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act, and there's some costs that can really impact some of us, and it can be a little scary. And I know it's a very politically charged topic, but as your tax advisor, I want to give you some specific tips here. So here's one. I just had a call this morning from a client. Said, Mark, I've got 10 employees. Now that the employees have to have insurance, all of them are saying, you better provide us insurance or I might have to go find another job because I don't want to go out and pay personally for insurance. See, what this has happened, again, everybody, is this fervor and this requirement, or you'll pay a penalty, that you've got to get insurance. And so employers are now feeling more pressure than ever to start providing insurance. Well, you can get the small business healthcare tax credit if you have less than 50 employees and the average wages are in this range or that range and la, la, la. You can go through all that. But again, what you're signing up for with insurance rates, that may not be acceptable to you. And, of course, you need to be out shopping as a small business owner on the exchanges and with private contractors. But here's the tip today. I've talked about them over and over again. They're a chapter in my book, The Health Reimbursement Arrangement. Here's what you can do for your employees. Give them a stipend. Give all the employees $300 or $400 or $500 and say, take this out there, go buy your insurance, and I'll reimburse you. And it's actually not a flat – you can do a flat fee under an HRA plan and give all the employees X number of dollars to pay for their own insurance or their out-of-pocket deductibles or dental or whatever. But there's also a plan called the Premium Reimbursement Plan, where you can just get a plan set up where all your employees would turn in their insurance invoice every month, and then you would just reimburse them. You get a tax deduction. It's tax-free income to the employee, and there's no FICA withholdings. Woo! Is that cool? Your employees are grateful. They're happy, excited. You get a write-off. They don't pay taxes on it. They satisfy the Obamacare requirement. Everybody's a winner, and you get better employees, and you retain them. And you may implement this rather than giving raises or bonuses this year and say, I'm going to start paying for everybody's insurance. Now, that strategy, if you want a link or a connection to a company doing premium reimbursement cafeteria plans, I've had Todd Kuhn on my show several times over the last 2 years, and they are ramping up for this. Group insurance is starting to disappear, and these companies are doing this reimbursement-type plan. If you need some contact info, send me an email. Say, Mark, I need your premium reimbursement HRA guy, and I'll send you the link, and you can get going on it. It's costing about $600 to $800. Well, I'm going to say $400 to $800 per year, depending on the number of employees you have, and it's done. And this is after, again, you're out shopping and looking at insurance rates. You may decide to just cover everybody's insurance. You may want to do the reimbursement. And guys, here's the trick. Because some of your employees, based on their income, might be getting a subsidy from the government. If they're getting a subsidy for their insurance, then the insurance premium is even going to be lower. And if you say, all I'll do is reimburse you for your insurance, bring me your receipt, you're only on the hook for the receipt portion, rather than just giving them a stipend and they go out to dinner with the leftover money. See what I'm saying? I don't know. There's lots of options here. If you're a small business owner with employees, give me a little email. I'll send you some contact info. You could continue your research there. But this is, for those that have, of course, been to my workshops and talked with me before, this is not a new topic, but it may be all of a sudden something that's a priority, so you need to tune in now. So good luck. I know it's tough. Well, folks, I am so excited for our guest today. This is something I've been wanting to cover for years, and I just haven't had the expert that I could rely on, and I'm so grateful. Being a part of Entrepreneur Magazine and Entrepreneur.com, I get to associate with great people, and I had several writers tell me, you've got to have Joel Labava on your show. He's amazing. He's known as the Franchise King. I'm like, hook me up. I want to have this guy on my show. He's awesome, it sounds like. So this is great. Joel, as I said earlier, is the author of the book, Become a Franchise Owner, The Startup Guide to Lowering Risk, Making Money, and Owning What You Do. He's known as the Franchise King around the country. He's a top advocate for franchise buyers. He provides important tips and crucial information for people that are considering franchise ownership as a path to freedom and control. On my newsletter today, you saw all the little topics that we could be going over here. An hour is not enough to have a guy like this on the show, so we're grateful to have him here today. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks for having me. I've been listening in, and it's interesting you were talking about boats and write-offs and stuff. You know, I have this moat around my castle, and there's this 60-foot old schooner sitting there, and I'm wondering what the heck I can do to write that thing off.
Ooh, okay. This is good. So we got a brainstorm here. Let's rub our hands together. Yeah.
Maybe yeah. Hey, thanks for having me. Really.
Yeah, you bet. Folks, if you haven't been to Joel's website, which we'll give that out, of course, sometime today, is you'll see he actually does live in a castle. And so this boat, we've got to figure out giving rides or tours for customers or something and get a business deduction there. Be fun. Well, Joe, franchises, man, how did you get in this business of franchises? Did you own a franchise when you were younger and just got hooked? Or how did you get into this business?
Well, you know, it's weird. I didn't wake up one day thinking to myself, I think I'm going to be a franchise advisor. But before that, I think I'm going to get some experience as a franchisee and join my dad's company. And I mean, nothing happened the way that I thought it would. I was in automobile franchising, managing some auto franchises. And my late father was one of the first franchise matchmakers in the country, a franchise broker. And I got downsized for the, I don't know, fifth time or so from an automobile franchise. And I was at that career pain point where I didn't know what to do. I knew what I didn't want to do anymore. And I've said it before, but I'll say it again for the people that haven't heard me before. I was really sick of working for a bunch of idiots, and but I didn't know what else to do. So I made the decision the day that I got canned that I'd never wanted to do that again, never feel powerless and just have someone own my destiny. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that it was over for that part of my life. I just knew it. I felt it. And my father was hammering on me after that happened to join his franchise consulting firm. And I was like, because he wanted me to throw some money in and really get active. And I mean, I know a little about franchising, but I don't really know about this part of franchising. And, a regular job is probably better for me. But the more I found out about what it was going to be like, the more I was like interested in it, because I would get to do public speaking and I would get to work with people and help them achieve their dreams. So I joined him. I was a franchise broker for about 11 years. And I was a franchisee of a group, a franchise brokerage group. And towards the end of my tenure there as a franchisee, I was finding out that I wasn't really a good franchisee. The more there were rules and the more that I felt that the group was just not really getting it, the more frustrating I got. I said, I gotta get out of here. So I went on my own and was a broker for a couple of years. And was getting a little burned out. I just didn't want to be a matchmaker. I wanted to go deeper and kind of look at the long tail in franchising, if I could call it that, and really say to myself, what can I do to really protect franchise owners? Because I was comfortable in my role because I would get paid huge commissions for matching people to franchises. That's what franchise brokers do. And I felt comfortable in my role. I consistently turned people away that I didn't think would be good franchise owners and that I thought were maybe risking too much. But I really wanted to become more of an advocate for them. So I created kind of a model of helping franchise owners, future franchise owners, learn how to buy a franchise and learn how to choose and really stress research and not get paid a commission. So it was a huge hit in my income.
Well, this is exciting, and I love what your story there. I know you. I could keep dragging it out of you and go on and on, but I really I'm fascinated again by small business, and I can tell you are as well, helping people find that dream and find the perfect fit for them, that marriage, if you will, as you said. You were helping people do. The one question I have many people ask is, Mark, I need to start a small business. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to get started. And I think people will go to the MLM industry, the multi-level marketing industry, because they see the price point very low to entry in a lot of ways.
Entry. Yep.
Yeah, and then they'll also maybe go to the internet and start some sort of website and start trying to sell some product. But I think many people don't realize is that franchising is not always a $500,000 McDonald's franchise. You can get into franchises much more affordably. Is that not the case? I mean, it doesn't have to be expensive to get into a franchise scenario.
You're right. If you have really good sales and or consulting skills, there's no reason for you to open up a franchise that requires a location, like a retail franchise or a food franchise. If you're really skilled at getting clients, there's no reason why you can't have a franchise that maybe you lease a small office space somewhere or you even work out of the house. Those franchises can be had for under $100,000, but you must realize that your clients are not coming to you. You must go out and find them. So there's give and take. If you have a retail franchise or a food franchise, people are always coming into your store, to your restaurant. If you're a consultant, if you're in a sales role, you're always going to find them. Huge difference, but there's also a huge difference in investment amount.
So if a person says, I want to start a small business on the side, are there franchises that are less of a time commitment, they don't, where someone doesn't feel like they've just invested their life savings and they have to quit their job? Are there franchises that could even be tackled part-time?
There are a few which in the industry are known as semi-absentee franchises. A great example would be a Great Clips or Sports Clips, where it's a hair salon. There's a managing cosmetologist in place. And you, as the owner, are really not there all that much. You can keep your job. As a matter of fact, franchisors like that want you to keep your job for a while anyway. So those opportunities are out there, but there's not that many of them, and you really have to have enough capital to do it, because you're going to have to become a multi-unit owner. So not only is it usually required that you sign on for three or more franchises, but you're going to need to have that to create a business that's viable.
Now, some people would say, well, if I'm going to start a business, I'm just going to go out and buy an existing business. But that can be dangerous as well. What do you tell people when they're considering buying a mom-and-pop business versus a franchise with a track record? I mean, there's pros and cons. Do you mind kind of exploring that for a moment?
Sure. There are pros and cons. First of all, if you're going to look at a straight franchise operation, whether it's an existing one or a startup where you're going to open the first location, first of all, make sure that you are the right fit, the right personality type for a franchise. In other words, don't be like Joel Labava. Be like someone who follows rules, that wants to follow rules, that's used to following rules. Because, you know, not only is there a 250-page operations manual for you to follow, but there's a lot of paperwork to sign, a lot of legal stuff to sign, and you have obligations as a franchisee, and of course the franchisor has obligations to you. So you need to make sure that you are 100% comfortable with following someone else's system. If you are not, and you really want to be more entrepreneurial and kind of march to the beat of your own drum, then looking at an existing mom-and-pop business could be a real good way to go. Here's the trick. When I was a franchise broker, a dear friend of mine, Barney, in Columbus, invited me to business broker training, just a kind of a one-day class. He was allowed to bring a guest. He wanted to learn more about it, and so he took me with him. And the greatest thing I learned, if you want to be a good business broker, you must convey to the seller how important it is to have a really, really solid reason for wanting to sell that business, and a truthful reason. Because most businesses for sale fall into the category of, well, my kids don't want to take it over, so I want to sell it, or for health reasons, or we're 80 years old, we're retiring, that's why we're selling the business. As a buyer of a business, as a buyer of an existing business, you had better be a really, really good Secret Service agent. I mean, you better be good at investigating and finding out why the heck that business is for sale. I don't want to freak people out, but not every time the reason given is the reason for the business being for sale.
You know,
and I'm sure that you've seen it in your career.
Oh yeah, I just this over the past 2 or 3 weeks, I've had some wonderful clients up in Northwest, and they've been looking at a small business. I'm going to say it's retail. I want to be careful because I don't want to share too much.
Yeah.
This is a client confidentiality
right.
relationship. But
yeah.
This is good for everybody to hear. But they were up in the Northwest, and they were looking at this little retail food service business. And it looks so cool, and they got lots of sales, and there's always a line. And then the owner was interested in bringing on a partner, not completely selling, but bringing on a partner.
Okay.
It's a great do your due diligence, and for 3 or 4 weeks they've been getting into the nitty-gritty, going through all of it. And come to find out, this seller, she is on the cliff of bankruptcy. She's upside down on all sorts of debt. She needs help. Now the business is, you know, it's got a great product and a great location,
okay,
and a great reputation.
Good.
But now they're trying to figure out, how can I get into this business without getting all the baggage? And the point being here is that when you're out buying an independent mom and pop business, I like how you said that. You've really got to be on top of your due diligence, be a Secret Service agent of sorts, and figure out what's going wrong. With a franchise, though, on the flip side, I would presume you've got to be able to rely a little bit on the franchise laws, that this business opportunity has been vetted, and that concern should really be focused on the other items, I would presume. Is that right? I mean,
there's that myth out there that I've written about, where a lot of people think that because it is a, quote, turnkey operation or a business in a box, that all they have to do is turn the key and they're in business and instant money comes in. you still have to do the research. You still have to do the most important thing, which is talk to franchisees that have already written the check and that own these businesses to find out what the deal is. If it's an existing franchise business, let's say that you're looking at buying a Subway, you know, in your little area of California, you find out it's for sale, you still have to find out, first of all, about the franchisor. You have to do some research on Subway. You have to call other Subway franchisees, not only in the area but from around the country, to get a good feel of what the business environment is like. And then you can dig into the franchisee's individual books and get an attorney and an accountant to help you out. But there is no guarantee that you will be successful as a franchise owner just because the model is successful.
Ooh, that is a really good point. I like what you said there. And it's a different type of research. You're going to spend time doing due diligence, but it's not to try to figure out what's wrong with the model. It's to figure out, is the model working in that area, maybe?
Exactly.
Because some franchises work wonderfully in one part of the country
and
work terrible in another. Very interesting. What are the characteristics of when someone says to themselves, okay, I'm thinking of shopping for a franchise, how do they analyze themselves? And I'm going to say this again. For anybody that's just joined us, this is a book you're going to want to get. And we're talking with Joel LaBava, and his book is titled Become a Franchise Owner, The Startup Guide to Lowering Risk, Making Money, Owning What You Do. So much of what we're talking about today, of course, is detailed in his book. You're going to want to get a copy if you've ever thought of owning a franchise. And we want to thank Joel for being with us today. But Joel, on this topic of kind of analyzing yourself, how do I find what franchise is best for me? Like, how do you do that? Like, what type of questions do you ask a new customer or client of yours?
I ask them what they're good at, you know. What are you good at? What kind of positions have you held in the past? You know, were you really good at operations, or are you a sales guy or a sales gal? Are you outgoing? Are you introverted? And also, I want you to close your eyes. What do you see yourself doing as the owner of a business? I don't care what kind of business it is. What do you see yourself doing? What's comfortable? A lot of people see themselves owning a storefront. Why? Well, because that's what I think when I think of franchising. Okay, fine. What kind of storefront? Do you have to be working in a storefront? So I really get them thinking beyond their visual of what a franchise is and start getting them to think about themselves more and what they want to be doing. Not necessarily aligning themselves with their hobby, but aligning themselves with the day in the life of. And once I start to get them thinking, I can start listening and hearing things that maybe make sense. Now, because I'm not a franchise broker anymore, I generally do not name specific franchise concepts. Instead, I talk about franchise sectors, or I might say, well, maybe a food franchise is right for you because you've had food experience, you know the business. Here are some up-and-coming franchise types in food franchises that you might want to look at. Unless I have personal knowledge and I happen to know the franchisor from a previous relationship, where I might say, you know what, you might want to look at this one. I like the guys. I'm not sure if it's a fit for you. I'm not getting anything out of it. I just want you to, because I know them a little bit, it's a nice little head start for you. So I recommend sectors more than specific opportunities, if that helps.
Very
you.
Good. Yeah. Now, okay, so where does one go to find the top franchise? And do you, I'm going to embed this with two questions. Do you want to look for the top franchises, or do you want to look for what you think is going to be the next top franchise? What's your take on that? Do you try to find the best?
Your personality has a lot to do with it. You know, do you want to be someone that's breaking ground? Do you want to be a groundbreaker? Do you want something that is going to be up and coming? You want to get in early? It's a young franchisor. Is that kind of your MO? Is that how you've been operating? Are you a little more of a risk taker? Or do you want something that's really, really well branded? Because for some reason that makes you comfortable. Do you want something that is a 10,000 franchise unit chain? Because you're just more comfortable with risk, and you view risk as something that, you know, is less risky if there's a brand name involved. So it has to do with you a lot, and I'm really, really good when I work with people at pulling that out of them to make sure they understand where they are in that risk scale. But, you know, hot franchises get cold. So I always encourage people to look beyond what's hot right now. And buying a franchise that's hot is okay as long as you feel, not me, but as long as you feel it's sustainable. And you know, like frozen yogurt, for instance, is a great franchise sector to pick on right now because they're everywhere. And I'm not going to pick on them, but what I'm going to say is if you're going to look at one of the 35 or 40 different frozen yogurt franchisors that are out there right now, here's what I want you to ask two or three of them, because that's how many I want you to look at least two or three, so you can get a nice comparison. Ask them what is next on the horizon. You know, what happens when frozen yogurt kind of gets, no pun intended, gets a little cold? What is your vision? Are you going to have add-on products? You know, what do you see your company, your franchise doing in 3 or 4 years? You know, see if the CEO has a vision. That way, if you're getting into something that's pretty hot, you can be more comfortable knowing that, hey, the CEO of this franchise is like off the charts genius and really, really has some good ideas for the future. I think I'm going to be okay. Something that not many people think of.
Yeah, no, this is fantastic. Now, where do people go to find the good franchises or find any franchise? Typically I've gone to, I know you work a lot with Entrepreneur and Entrepreneur.com.
Yep.
They've got a great franchise section on their website, a great annual magazine.
Yep.
The back of the magazine's packed. Is that one of the best resources out there? Where do you start looking?
Yeah. Even if I wasn't writing for them, it's one of the best resources out there. And so I'm not biased. I would also say I work with Franchise Direct. We have a strategic partnership. FranchiseDirect.com is a really nice, busy place, very heavily trafficked website. To take the bias out, FranchiseGator.com is another huge franchise website where there's a lot of things. FranchiseOpportunities.com. I mean, there are well over 100 franchise web portals, but I don't want you starting with any of them until you figure out what type of business you feel would be a nice fit for you based on your skills and some of your personal traits and what you see yourself doing as an owner. That is the key.
Yeah, it is true, because you could probably say, if you don't do that personal analysis first, I can imagine myself getting on one of these websites and going, oh my gosh, that bike shop looks like so cool. I'd love to be selling mountain bikes every day. That's what I'll do. And then I come to find out, I buy it, and then, oh, I'm really a glorified mechanic here every day. I don't like
you're not having any fun.
And,
yep.
I mean, I like riding bikes, but do I like being
a
bike owner, a bike business? And
that's
probably where people get in problems taking their hobby and trying to buy a franchise around their hobby.
That happens a lot.
Let's get back to the cost of entry again. So when people say, okay, I want to get a franchise, and I've seen service-oriented franchises that can be as low as $1,000 to $5,000 to just get in a network of some sort and get a box of goodies and get out and kind of hit the ground. Of course, the lower priced entry, your potential isn't going to be as higher as well. But what about your credit score? What about cash down? How difficult can it be? Is it important to partner with other people? What do you advise clients on that issue?
Credit right now, you better have good credit, or it's going to be real tough for a small business lender to take you seriously. So definitely do a credit check. You can do them free. I think it's freecreditreport.com, something like that. You know the site's better than I do. But get a free credit report. So you can make sure that your bills have been paid on time and that you look way above average to the banks. And I think that it's really, really important to do that early before you even start looking for a franchise. And then try to figure out your budget.
Let me interject this real quick. Now, now it is true, some people that are going to go borrow money to start the franchise, their credit's going to matter. Do franchisors care if the franchisee has bad credit? Is that going to be?
Absolutely.
Say I've got cash.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Franchisors, at a certain point in the process, usually pretty early, will be running a credit check and sometimes even a background check on you.
Mm. Okay.
That's right.
So I guess
so. If
I guess
you're paying with cash, but you never paid a bill on time, they might not want you.
Yeah, and I guess I can't go open that preschool franchise because that background check's going to kill me. no, I'm just joking, folks. Yeah. That was a bad joke.
you know, I'm on that network. They have me identified. I'm just playing. But no, is doing a background check too. I like it. So credit check. Now, this is where partnering might be important for someone. If they say, well, I've got my brother, sister, family member, friend that's got good credit, and you've got the cash, or you want to do the work, do you see many people partner in a franchise acquisition?
I see a lot of people talking about it. if anyone wants to partner, I have them see someone like you. I have them see an accountant and or an attorney, and I have them say, okay, you want to partner with this person? That's fine. Here's what you need to do before we even talk. Get a formal partnership agreement signed, everything in writing, and let me know when it's done. Because if you're not willing to do that, you're not going to have a partner. Because it requires you to get some background on them. They're going to get some background on you. I don't care if it's your brother-in-law. You're going to know their finances. They're going to know your finances because you really have to kind of work with each other to disclose it. And it could get a little tricky. So get that uncomfortable part out of the way. Get a formal agreement even if you don't want to. Because that will take, psychologically, that will take you to a different place. And it's like, you know, are you a player or are you a talker? Because it's real easy, if you're the one that is a little light on funds, it's real easy to say, well, my uncle will certainly loan me money. He always said he would. All right, what kind of partnership agreement are you going to have? You know, it's probably a little less important with family than it is with non-family, but I would still recommend doing it. Partnerships are weird. My father always taught me that, you know, people that want a franchise, you know, that want to buy a franchise with a partner, while it's true that the money up front can be split, you have to make twice as much money as the franchise, you know, as a franchisee because you have to split it both ways. So, you know, it's good up front, but, you know, in the back end, you have to make twice as much money. You're paying two families.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Great point. Well, you're still in my thunder. I love what you're talking about. And we've talked about partnering here so often, so many times, about talking about the worst case and the best case scenarios and vetting that relationship at the beginning. I love your comment. Now, let's talk about that quote-unquote partnership with the franchisor or the franchise, because that's really what you're doing too, is you're partnering with this person, which is usually there's a brand or a person behind the franchise that's telling you how great it is, whether it's what's his name on Papa John's, he's on all the Super Bowl commercials. I still think he does himself
John,
a disservice.
John something or other, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm like, Dave, you're not an actor. Do not do your own commercials.
He's but, so far off my radar screen for some of the stuff he said that I disagree.
Yeah, but you are partnering with this company, this franchise. What are your thoughts on the royalties you're going to pay, on the costs that they require from you? What are the percentages that you need to be cautious of as you're looking at these different franchises? How do you tell when a franchise is being greedy or they just are, ugh? You know, what do you look for?
Yeah, you know, it's happened. I've had people work with me in the past who have said, look, I'm looking at this franchisor. It looks like a cool concept. They're brand new. They only have one franchisee right now, and they have a $40,000 franchise fee. And I say, what? Because the average franchise fee is about $25,000, $30,000. So I'm thinking, what is very special about this that they're $40,000 or $45,000 right out of the gate? So I want them to do a little more digging than usual. So the average franchise fee, $25,000 to $30,000, it's reasonable. It is a one-time upfront fee. You basically are becoming a licensee, a franchisee. You know, you get to use the trademarks and the software and everything else involved with the business. The royalties are where the franchisor makes the money. To do the math, let's say that I own a pizza franchise. I'm the franchisor, and I've managed over the last 10 years to sell 500 franchises. So if every franchisee is paying me 5% in royalties every month, and let's say let's keep it in fives. Let's say that my 500 franchisees are each doing $500,000 a year in sales, and they're paying me 5% of that, okay? So I'm getting $25,000 a year, right, times 500 franchisees. $25,000 times 500 franchisees is how franchisors make money. It's not from the franchise fee. It's from the royalties. So that's why franchises need to scale and need to grow, because it is a royalty-based income stream for them.
Is 5% what you see out there is typical?
5-6% is pretty normal. It can be a little higher. Sometimes it's 7%. Sometimes with a consulting, coaching kind of franchise, it might be 12% or 15%. It just depends. It depends.
Well, we've got a question here via email. I should have said that early on. I have many of my listeners know that and we've got a live caller here that I need to bring out here on the line. I apologize. Let me just make sure I've got him brought out here. In fact, Lisa, our show host here, I'm going to just ask her. Hey, Lisa, do we still have our caller here on the line?
Yes, we do.
Okay. All right. I'll jump right
Tom
over there.
Tom,
gotcha.
Perfect.
Well, I love Tom. I know Tom. All right. Here we go. I just spoke to him this last week, Mr. Tom Gazaway. How's it going, Tom? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark, and hi, Joel. I had a quick question, but congrats, by the way, on that big win last weekend, Mark. That was pretty huge. And this is a great call. I mean, obviously, Joel's, you know, top of the chart, so to speak, with the franchise thing. I kind of have two questions, if I can sneak in, too. One is, are franchisees entrepreneurs, is my first question. And my second question, Joel, is there any way of knowing how the franchise failure rate compares to the non-franchise failure rate in any kind of reliable way?
Ah, great question.
Great.
The first
great question.
One.
We'll take that offline. Yeah.
Now, the first one, since my memory is so bad, what was the first one again?
First question is, would you consider a franchisee an entrepreneur?
Ah, yes. One of my favorite topics that I've been writing about and arguing about with people for years. My view of this is that franchisees are, in general, not entrepreneurs. The franchisor, the person that came up with a concept, is the true entrepreneur.
Okay.
There are entrepreneurial things that franchisees do. If they, you know, if the structure is loose enough in the franchise agreement where they could do some creative marketing, there's certainly entrepreneurial stuff. But in general, the franchisor is the entrepreneur, and would-be franchise owners need to realize that and understand it.
That's a great point. Now, let's talk failure rate. We've only got two or three minutes left here. So what do you think? Do franchisees have a better success rate than someone going out and just starting a business from scratch?
Not necessarily. There are still franchise brokers who are brand new. They are still putting on their websites that franchises have a 95% failure rate, or they have a it is a bunch of crap. It's been the statistics have been bandied around for years, and it got so bad that the International Franchise Association, which is the largest association in the industry, wrote a letter to all their members saying, "Stop doing it. Stop saying it. The statistic is not true." So today's view of the statistic is that franchise business versus an independent business can be a little more low risk, but not necessarily, and that people going into a franchise should not look at it as something that has a much better chance of succeeding. A lot of things have to line up. You know, a lot of things have to happen right. The person buying the franchise has to be a fit for the franchise. The person has to be a rule follower. The person has to have enough money to do this and have enough backup cash. The geographic location has to be right. The physical location in the city has to be right. The environment, the economy has to be right. A lot of things have to come into play for it to be a real success. And it happens.
Well, let me interject here. Excellent points. And Tom, thank you for that call.
Thank you, Tom.
Great question. Yeah, great questions. And I had a couple via email here that just came in at the last second here. But, folks,
sure.
Our time's running out, so I want to make sure we get this out there. Folks, head to, it's easy, thefranchiseking.com. Joel Labava, he'll rock your world. If you're interested in any sort of a franchise opportunity, his book is a must. We're grateful to have him here with us. Joel, thanks so much for being. Oh, we've got a studio mistake there. I apologize. So, Joel, okay. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff, and we truly appreciate it. We'll hope to have you back here on again.
Fantastic.
Thanks. All right. Thanks, everybody. Get over there, thefranchiseking.com, and don't give up on your dreams. A franchise may be the very way to get there. So, God bless. Hang in there.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.